I believe we are joined now by Stephen Kimber. Are you there, sir?
I am. Hello, how are you?
Very good. It's great to talk to you. Say, Mr. Kimber, that I have interviewed lawyers and I've interviewed members of the family of the Cuban Five and on the show, and I was under the impression that I really understood the story, but frankly, until I read your book, What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five, I realize there's a lot to know. And it's a very, very readable and terrific book. I almost want to sign up for your journalism course.
We could use you, sure.
Yeah, okay, well, consider this an application.
Sure.
Now, you're going to come and talk on Sunday at Ryerson, 2 p.m., mm-hmm. and on the 7th floor, 55 Dundas. We're very much up to date here with this matter, because today in the New York Times there's been an editorial calling for an exchange. I hate to say they use the word swap, but at any rate, because there is an American being held in Cuba, Mr. Gross, I believe his name is, and of course there are three Cubans being held by the U.S. government, and New York Times seems to me, I guess it's a breakthrough discussing this. So I guess I better ask you right off the bat. Your book, I would tell, by the way, anybody considering whether this ought to go forward, they ought to read your book. But how are you reacting to this news today?
Well, I'm very pleased. I think that, you know, this has been growing. There are complications with this. Nothing comes without price, and nothing is exactly as you would like it. But the New York Times is obviously a newspaper of record in the United States, a newspaper that has influence in Washington. And, you know, they didn't couch this particularly, which, you know, is often a concern. They used some of the arguments that came from the Atlantic Court in 2005, which was the court ruling that favored the Cuban Five, and so they actually put this stuff on the record, and that hasn't really been done before in a major mainstream American newspaper. So I think that's really important. But, you know, in fact, if you look at what's been the build up to this,
mm-hmm.
You know, last spring you had 66 members of Congress writing a letter, and they weren't. You had to read between the lines, but what they were saying was, start some negotiations. Just pretend that they're not equivalent, that you can't talk about them together. Let's get some negotiations. Their concern, obviously, was to get Alan Gross home, but they recognize that part of that process is that the Cuban Five, the remaining members of the Cuban Five, have to be freed as well. So, you know, that's been very important. And I think, you know, there's been a kind of a perfect storm in the last little while. You had Ebola, and, you know, even the hard right in Miami had a hard job trying to spin that as a bad thing, you know, the Cuban contribution to the fight against Ebola, and in fact, you know,
disproportionately large compared to the great superpower.
This is nothing new,
mm-hmm.
but in fact that they've been doing for years. So that was one thing, and then, you know, the pressure from Latin American countries who say, you know, you want to come to the summit of the Americas next April, Cuba's going to have to be there too, or else it doesn't happen. Those, you know, so in a more general sense, the tone is changing.
Yeah, the U.S. in a sense is finding itself isolated from years of trying to isolate Cuba. Is that right?
I think, in fact, it's backfired, and it's starting to come to the fore. I think that, you know, the imprisonment of the Five is sort of one part of it. But then, you know, you also have the desire. We may not like this, but the Cubans are more than capable of making up their own minds. But clearly, there is a desire from American business to end the embargo so that they can go back into Cuba and sell whatever it is they want to sell. And they have begun to put pressure on the United States. There was a delegation from the Chamber of Commerce that was in Havana not so long ago, and you know, groups like, you know, that most of us haven't heard much about, like the American Soybean Association, which is a producers association, mm-hmm. is saying, end the embargo. Let's, you know, this is crazy. It hasn't worked. Let's stop trying to do it. And mm-hmm. people seem to be less afraid, for the most part, of the Miami Cubans and their power. And that again, is another major change in the climate.
Well, I have to say, by the way, and again, we're speaking to Stephen Kimber, and the book is What Lies Across the Water, terrific title. The word lies staring me in the face, the real story of the Cuban Five. Now, you really got into, at least for me, I noticed something that I hadn't realized before. This great, powerful lobby that everybody said, well, we have to toe the line. You know, the Cubans are going to get unhappy in Miami if we try to change. But you say that Richard Allen, going way back, and you can tell me who he is, he got together with a really wonderful, reputable fellow named Jorge Mascanosa, and said, we think it'd be a good idea if you had a lobby.
And what they intended to create, this is back in the early 1980s, so right after Ronald Reagan came into office in the United States, what they intended to create was a lobby very much like the Israel lobby in the United States. So a very powerful lobby that would help to underwrite congressional campaigns and push for legislation, write legislation, and they did that. But the other thing that they did, and this is sort of where the Cuban Five comes into it, is in 1992, at a meeting in Naples, Florida, they created a secret paramilitary. So you have, on the one hand, these people who are going to Washington, meeting in the White House with the top officials in the land, and on the other hand, they're plotting the overthrow of the Cuban government with a paramilitary that they financed with millions of dollars. So, you know, this sort of allowed to go unchecked meant that there was going to be, you know, there would be more attacks on Cuba and more serious attacks. And so the Cubans were able to infiltrate that group, and they knew what they were planning. And that's, you know, again, part of this very complicated but very interesting story of what the Cubans were doing in the United States. That's one of the parts that's left out of the New York Times editorial. It doesn't explain that, in fact, what they were trying to do was to stop terrorist attacks against Cuba.
They seem to be very good at what they did. The subtitle, of course, is The Real Story of the Cuban Five. So what is the real story? Why did they come to... Why was it necessary for the government of Cuba, in their opinion, to send agents in the United States to keep track of people like this wonderful man, Mr. Canosa?
Well, after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a real feeling in Miami that, like a lot of the Soviet allies in Eastern Europe, Cuba was simply going to fall, and next year they could march back in and take over again. These were a lot of exiles who had, you know, roles in the Batista government or had connections back to it, and that's what they thought.
They sort of have a motto, don't they? Next year in Havana?
Next year in Havana, exactly. And they were plotting those things and beginning to carry them out. There were many attacks. I mean, these go back, obviously, to the time of the revolution, but they were ramping them up in the early 1990s. And so the Cubans knew that this was being done, and the only way to stop it, because the American government had laws on the books. I mean, there's a law called the American Neutrality Act that prohibits somebody from plotting to attack a third country from inside the United States. That was clearly happening, and there was no effort by American authorities to stop it. So the Cubans sent these agents over, whose job was to infiltrate these various groups, and there were a lot of them in Miami, and report back to Havana on what they were doing, and then Havana could stop them. Now, in terms of what they stopped, how they stopped them, mostly they arrested them, right? They arrived at the airport with the bomb-making equipment, and the Cubans knew they were coming and arrested them. So it was a very legitimate. They weren't going out and assassinating anybody or shooting anybody. Mm-hmm. It was a very lawful process carried out by a government that was under fire. The only thing that was illicit about it was that they didn't tell the American government what they were doing. But if they told the American government what they were doing, they wouldn't have been able to do it.
And let me ask you that. Isn't it... rather serious efforts have been made by this government, have they not, to actually achieve some cooperation? That is, they say, we have some information, we're giving it to you. As a matter of fact, you quote the letters in What Lies Across the Water, the real story of the Cuban Five, where a correspondence where they write to the U.S. Interest Section and say, my dear fellow, et cetera, we have information that a criminal named so-and-so is up to something. We expect you to look into that.
It worked both ways, and it was very interesting in the lead-up to the time when the Cuban Five were arrested, that the U.S. government was also secretly giving the Cubans information that they'd gathered. Now, the Cubans had, in most cases, already gathered that same information on their own. But there was cooperation, and there was a growing sense before the arrest of the Cuban Five that, you know, things might start to get better between the United States and Cuba. And then what seems to have happened, and to just sort of pick up on that, Fidel Castro sent a secret message to Washington through Gabriel Garcia Marquez to the White House. They looked at this, what the Cubans were saying, and what they were saying was that there was a plot to blow up an airplane filled with tourists coming to Cuba, which would have been from Europe or Canada or perhaps from South America. And, you know, they took that seriously, and the Cubans said, here's who's plotting it, it's being done. And the FBI went to Havana in June of 1998 and met with the Cuban state security people for 3 days, and they turned over all sorts of information to them. The FBI was supposed to go back and investigate, and instead, 3 months later, the Cuban Five were arrested. And instead of arresting the terrorists, they arrested the people who were working to uncover what they were up to. Mm. So the truth is that, you know, up to that point, there was a feeling, I think, in both Washington and Havana at various levels that something could be done to improve relations. And what we don't know exactly what happened between June when the FBI went to Havana and September when the five were arrested, but it appears that the FBI chief in Miami, who was very close to a number of the exiles, and some of whom had been identified by the Cubans as terrorists, was trying to short-circuit this. And he, instead of having allowing the FBI agents, who already were conducting surveillance of the members of Cuban Five, to continue to do it, they switched it, and it became a criminal investigation. And that's when they arrested them.
Mm-hmm. You know, it strikes me, part of this is, everybody has a, you know, dynamic and complicated politics. One of the things that comes out in your book is that these guys who are involved, some of the central characters, who really, by the way, you were going to write a novel, and believe me, these guys, if you'd put them in a novel, we all would have said, well, that's a, you know, you're pulling my leg, come on. The guy can't be involved in the Bay of Pigs and the Iran-Contra. But have this, they were involved with Iran-Contra, and some of that was Democrats and Republicans pulling the rug out from each under each other for their own advantage, is my memory, which makes it rather, must make it rather difficult for Cuba to get a straight answer out of the Americans.
I think it has been, over the years, very difficult. I mean, I think that, you know, the truth is both countries deeply mistrust the other for, certainly in the case of the Cubans, very good reasons. They've been, you know, lied to. They've been, they've had people coming to try and overthrow their government who were at the very least tacitly supported by the U.S. government. So, you know, they have lots of reasons to mistrust. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that seems to be happening now, and I think the next 2 years will be really interesting in all of this, because after the midterm American elections tomorrow, the electoral question is off the table for Obama. He doesn't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. The big issue, which I think may make it more difficult, at least until the last moment of his presidency, to go forward and do what the New York Times suggested, is that there is an anti-Cuban senator named Robert Menendez, who is now chair of the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee, and the Obama administration needs him on other stuff, you know, on Iraq and ISIL and all of that stuff, and they don't want to, you know, irritate him to the point where he's going to work against them. And that's part, you know, American politics, well, politics generally, but certainly American politics where, you know, you violate what should be your principles.
Yeah, or even your best interests.
Kowtow to somebody like Menendez so he'll support you on other things.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad commentary in many ways.
And by the way, Cuba would find, I think, even some Canadian officials would say it is hard to get a deal with the U.S. because they can't. They say yes in the morning and maybe in the afternoon, no in the next day. By the way, we're speaking to What Lies Across. We're not speaking to the book. We're speaking to Stephen Kimber, who wrote the book What Lies Across the Water. The real story of the Cuban Five. Incidentally, there is, you should know, StephenKimber.com, a terrific site. And Stephen Kimber is going to be in town this coming Sunday, the 9th, at 2 p.m. at Ryerson. And it's the 7th floor. It'll go 2 to 5. I have to say, I want to make sure we note this. You started from an instinct position. I think you did, was it 2009
mm-hmm.
that you were on a trip to Cuba thinking of writing, I guess, Our Man in Havana and or The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. But you met somebody, and you really picked up the story in 2009 because this is the most thorough and close account I've ever read. So that's really the case?
Yeah, well, it's really the case. I mean, one of the things that happened this was a person I met in Cuba who told me a little bit about the story and told me about the involvement of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, which clearly was intriguing to me. And when I got back to Canada, I started to, you know, track down information that I could find. And the more information I found, the more, I guess I became obsessed by this story. And it was for the first 6 or 8 months, I mean, I was thinking of it primarily as a story, as a, you know, this is just a fascinating story of espionage and the back and forth and all of that sort of stuff. But after I finished reading the transcript of this trial, I realized that, you know, this is also an incredible story of an injustice. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I think since then, I'm a journalist. I tend not to like to get involved in things, but this is a case where I have felt that I know enough about it based on the research to be able to make an argument that this is an injustice and that something needs to be done to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, well, I want to say something about your due diligence. You've been in and out of a few courtrooms, too. You were actually in the courtroom in El Paso and saw one of the most celebrated villains, as far as I'm concerned, Mr. Posada. You saw him with your own eyes.
I did, and it was a very interesting exercise to go and see that, because here is somebody who, by his own admission, is a terrorist, and he has been involved in assassination plots against Fidel Castro. He was the orchestrator of a terrible act of air terrorism back in 1976.
One of the first cases, right?
That's right. They blew up a plane, a Cubana Airlines plane, and killed 73 people in the name of freedom for Cuba. That was who he was. And so to see him being charged. But it was very, I mean, he was charged in a very interesting way. He was charged with lying to an immigration official when he came into the United States because the immigration official had asked him if he had been involved in a series of terror attacks against Cuba in Havana in 2000 or in 1997, which was a series of hotel bombings. And he said no. Now, they didn't charge him with being involved in those attacks. They charged mm-hmm. him with lying about being involved in those attacks. So, they couldn't bring themselves to charge him.
Almost slapped his wrist. Came within a hair of breath.
and to make matters worse, to add insult to injury, of course, he was acquitted by the jury in El Paso.
Well, that is Mexican territory. It's occupied by Texans. No, that is very, and he now lives free and doesn't have to pay for his meals when he walks down the streets in Miami.
That's right. He is a hero to many, particularly the old guard in Miami, and there have been a number of events, dinners, nights in his honor. Even after, you know, it was clear that this man is a terrorist, and you know, I mean, I guess I go back to 2001 when George Bush said, you know, if you harbor a terrorist, you are a terrorist. I mean, to saying to other countries, all that time, the United States government has been harboring terrorists in Miami. There was Posada, but there before him, there was Orlando Bosch, who was another one, and there's a whole group of them in Miami who are not only living free, but are upstanding citizens in Miami.
Again, it's Stephen Kimbert, by the way, stephenkimbert.com. You know, your book does describe that, and they do have a neutrality act, and I guess the question is, rhetorically is that just an act? Because there have been all kinds of criminal actions where they've been actually intercepted by the FBI. They set up traps and caught them, and then according to your book, nobody ends up in the slammer.
Well, very, very rarely does anybody end up in the slammer, and I think that's
especially the big shots.
They have a term for it in law enforcement in Florida, and the term is admonition. So, in other words, they don't want trouble, or that was that was the thing. So they will often find out about these terrorist plots, and rather than arrest somebody for doing it, they will find a way to destabilize that and to send a message. Don't do this, or don't do this now.
But by the way, I'm sorry, but reading your book, I began to double out think myself, but some of these guys appear to be the kind of guys who want you to catch them on the way to the airport so that they don't get hurt.
There were certainly some of those.
Then they go back to Miami and brag again, and everybody takes them out to dinner, and they get awards, and they get funded, but nobody got hurt.
Well, that's true in some cases. There have been, though, a huge number of cases in which there really were serious terrorist attacks that were carried out against Cuba by these kinds of people.
So, a Canadian was killed at a hotel.
That's right. In the 1997 bombings, Fabio De Chelmo, who was a young Montreal-based businessman who lived part of the time in Havana with his father, and interestingly enough, after he was killed, his father moved to Havana permanently and lives there today. He's quite an old man now, but he's still there.
Mm-hmm.
That was where he needed to be.
Yeah. We're speaking, of course, to Stephen Kimber, and I want to make sure I say this, ask you about this gentleman. Because I have talked on this show, we interviewed some lawyers involved in the case. Of course, this has gone on for years. And one of the things that I've been told is that Gerardo Hernandez is sort of a special guy in the eyes of the U.S. And here we are today, the New York Times editorial saying, let's make a prisoner exchange. He was sentenced to double life plus 15 years.
Right.
Mr. Gross, of course, got 15 years in Cuba. Now, you've corresponded with Gerardo Hernandez, and tell us about him, and what do you think, is that one of the things that's going to prevent an exchange?
I think ultimately no, because a couple of things. Anybody, he's in there for double life plus 15 years because he was charged with conspiracy to commit murder in as a result of a shoot down of two planes flown by a group of exiles that were shot down in the Florida Straits back in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
They claimed that he was involved, that he knew about this, but the record doesn't show that. And in fact, the court case was so bad that at the end, when the judge issued her instructions to the jury, the prosecutors rushed off to the appeal court and said, "We can't have the judge saying these things because we didn't. If those instructions stand, it means that we didn't prove our case and we're going to lose." Mm-hmm. The appeal court said, "No, just go. The jury's heard this. Let the jury decide." And of course, a Miami jury decided that he was guilty. I think that it's becoming clearer and clearer to people in the United States government, in various pockets of the United States government, that trial was a travesty of justice. And they're not going to admit that, but now how do we get out of this? I think they would like Hernandez out of here to go back. He's also been a model prisoner. I mean, he hasn't done anything in his 16 years in prison that would cause any reason why they wouldn't let him go free. And I think he's, certainly from my experiences with him, which have all been by mail, mm-hmm. because he's not allowed to communicate and I'm not allowed to see him.
Mm-hmm.
He is an incredibly bright, thoughtful guy. If he does get back to Havana,
mm-hmm.
I think you may see him at some point in a political role. He's very smart, and he's, as I said, he's very thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
He would make I think he would make a good political leader at some point.
Yeah, well, by the way, you talk about a nation of 10 million people trying to defend itself against a superpower, proud of being a superpower, and they're rather capable of doing it,
mm-hmm.
and in a nonviolent way, I have to say.
No, and that was the interesting thing about the five. Again, when you look at the trial transcript, you realize that there was no evidence of any violence that they had actually committed in their time there.
Mm-hmm.
What they were there to do was to find out and to report back, and that's essentially what they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great book, What Lies Across the Water, the real story of the Cuban Five. Stephen Kimber, stephenkimber.com. We look forward to seeing you here in Toronto at Ryerson at 2 o'clock on Sunday.
I look forward to seeing you as well.
Okay.
Take care now.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. That's Stephen Kimber. And again, go to his site. He's got a great site. And he's done so much. The book is full of incredible details and great stories. It's you like to read an adventure. You like a detective story. It's got all that in it. Amazing personalities. They couldn't have been dreamed up by Jimmy Breslin or Graham Greene. As they say, they would have told the editor would have said, "You better dial it back." Incidentally, I found reading the book that some of these people, like Posada and the man Bosch, were very aware of themselves, and they while they were highly secretive, they also, when they were talkative, had a very romantic notion of who they of their own identities. And frankly, it's laughable as you see it. I mean, it is. If you've ever seen Our Man in Havana, there's a lot of these Our Man in Havana people in Stephen Kimber's What Lies Across the Water, the real story of the Cuban Five. And it's stephenkimber.com.